Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Things appear to be heating up in the Russia investigation. Special Counsel Robert Mueller has requested White House records and emails about the firing of former FBI Director James Comey, about the ouster of National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. Mueller is also zeroing in on former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort. There are big questions about Manafort's offer of private election briefings to a Russian oligarch with close ties to the Kremlin. And there's more. This hour on Point, the latest on Robert Mueller's investigation of Russia and the Trump campaign. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are you watching the signs of what's going on in there? What's your question on the Mueller investigation and the president? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. At that campaign rally anywhere in Alabama on Friday, all of this was on the mind of the president. He went down to campaign for Luther Strange to be Alabama's senator. Couldn't help talking about Russia while he was there.
Russia did not help me. That I can tell you, okay? Any Russians in the audience? Are there any Russians in the audience, please? I don't see too many Russians. I didn't see too many Russians in Pennsylvania. I didn't see too many Russians.
But Robert Mueller has plenty of Russia material in his sights. Later this hour, we'll turn to the NFL in a game of, in a game day of protest after President Trump attacked players who take a knee. But first, the Russia investigation. Joining us now from Washington is Carol Lenig, reporter for The Washington Post, who has been in the thick of it. Carol Lenig, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Also with us from Washington, Ryan Lizza, Washington correspondent for The New Yorker. Ryan Lizza, welcome back to On Point.
Hey, my pleasure.
Ryan, can you just start with walking us through, and Carol, you've been so deep in this, and we're going to go deep with you. But Ryan, walk us through. This was a big week. The last 10 days, is just a lot that's come out. I think it's hard for people to keep track of. What are the most important things that have unfolded or emerged, reported from the Mueller investigation that may give us some sense of where it's headed?
Well, I think there are probably three areas, and Carol can probably help me if I miss something.
Please do, Carol. Yeah,
where I think there have been significant developments, mostly playing out over the last week and a half.
Mm-hmm.
One is on Paul Manafort, who of course seems to be in the most imminent legal jeopardy, if the reporting is accurate. The New York Times has reported that he has been told that he's likely to be indicted, and. So lots of developments on the Manafort front. I think the most intriguing one from my perspective are these emails that leaked out, apparently leaked out from one of the congressional committees, where he's corresponding with an intermediary about this Russian oligarch who has been sort of one of the questions in the whole Manafort story is, after all these years, Manafort working in Ukraine and cozying up to Oleg Deripaska, this Russian oligarch, and having some kind of falling out with him over money. Was there some kind of reason that he showed up in the United States after all this time, after sort of disappearing from American politics, cozied his way into the Trump campaign, was he trying to pay back, offer any payback to some of the people he had relationships with in the Ukraine and Russia? And, you know, that was always sort of, in my opinion, a bit of a conspiracy theory about Manafort. And then suddenly, lo and behold, we have this email where he is apparently offering to give the guy briefings about the campaign. So just a tiny bit of news there. We don't know exactly what that means, but it's certainly, if you're someone who is in a financial dispute with a Russian oligarch and you're suddenly running the Trump campaign where the Russians have offered to help, that's certainly an avenue that I think investigators are going to pursue aggressively. So
this oligarch had accused Manafort of essentially, you report, stealing millions of dollars from him, and the suggestion
right.
here that Manafort may have been looking for a way out of that bind.
That's been a theory that has been floating out there for a long time, and frankly, without any evidence. And this is the first piece of evidence where you start to scratch your head and say, huh, why is Manafort offering to give this guy a briefing, someone who he's in a financial litigation
with? And someone who's very close to Vladimir Putin. There's the beginning of the Manafort piece, and we'll return
exactly.
to it.
Carol, so that's very intriguing.
Let me turn to Carol for another piece of this, Carol, and you pick your piece. I mean, everybody's been reporting, the Post has been doing great work on this, but we'll come back to Manafort. But what else, where would you point to say, here are big signs of what's happening with the Mueller investigation?
So we've known for some time, I guess if you compare this to a kitchen, there's like a stove and you had it on low, you got the pilot light going,
okay.
and now we're up to not near boil, but we're seeing some action at the bottom of the pan.
Mm-hmm.
And we've known for a while that Michael Flynn, the former National Security Advisor, and Paul Manafort, Trump's former campaign chairman, were both in legal jeopardy and were the central focus of Bob Mueller, at least initially, along with Mueller's probe that looks at possible obstruction of justice by the president and the White House aides. Now you're starting to see a lot of action in relationship to Flynn and also in relationship to Manafort. The story that The Post, my colleagues and I mm-hmm. at The Post yep. broke about Manafort shows you that not only did they do a search warrant, execute a no-knock search warrant at his house, which indicates they have evidence, they've convinced a judge in a secret sealed hearing that they have evidence a crime been committed, but you also see in these emails we released and revealed and described that he, for the first time, we have some indicia that a top campaign official was opening a back door in the back of the campaign to somebody very close to the top of the Russian government. Now, Oleg Deripaska, one of the wealthiest men in Russia, mm-hmm. is a complex figure, as Ryan has properly described. He is a person who has many times been a front prong, if you will, for Putin, and has been on the outs with Putin from time to time
yep.
as well. But he is an easy 1 to 2 to 3 top person that could get Putin on the phone if he wanted to. So it's important to know that there was this backdoor channel. We also reported, as did the Times, the category of materials that the White House is now having to turn over to Mueller. It's been weeks in the making. The White House lawyers are scurrying around trying to gather all these records that the special counsel's team is asking for. And some of them are, you know, just obvious and basic, and yet they're still fascinating. In these categories, Mueller has asked for any document, any record, anything that has to do with Paul Manafort. That's pretty broad. He's also asked for the things that would worry you if you were the president. And we are told from White House sources that the president is getting increasingly twitchy about these very specific requests. They focus on what the president said on Air Force One to his communications aides, to his son, Donald Trump, in crafting a public statement about how to explain why his son had this meeting with a Russian lawyer in the middle of the campaign at Trump Tower in 2016. As we all know now, because of the story that The Post wrote, it appears that the president shaped a statement that was misleading and did not explain that this was about the campaign and this was a meeting aimed at getting incriminating information from Hillary Clinton. There are other things that the counsel has asked the White House to turn over, and we're told that some of these records have already been sent, but many have not. And they also focus very much on the president's actions, what he said about firing Comey, what he said in the days before he ever met with Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein in describing his reasons for wanting to fire the man who was running the Russia probe and looking at whether or not Trump's campaign had colluded with the Putin government.
Here's a little bit from Preet Bharara. This is the former U.S. attorney from the Southern District of New York, fired earlier this year by President Trump, telling CNN's State of the Union yesterday that Special Counsel Mueller should be looking, he says, at obstruction of justice in the Russian investigation.
Any prosecutor or investigator who sees the evidence that has come forward, including the firing of Jim Comey, including the conversations about how much the president did not like the Russia investigation, including what he said about Michael Flynn, all of that together paints a picture of potential obstruction. And Bob Mueller is a thorough and serious person and fearless. And I think he's got to go there.
So obstruction of justice, is that where at this point this might come closest to the president, Ryan, or are there other paths that lead to the Oval Office?
I think so. I mean, everything that Carol just laid out and everything we know about where Mueller's investigation is with respect to Trump personally points to a potential obstruction of justice case. I'm not an expert on the law and those aren't particularly easy cases to prove. But all of the meetings and events that he seems keen on knowing more about point to that. And you can understand why Carol said that the president is getting a little twitchy about this, because once those requests come in and he realizes that everything that he said publicly about this is going to be checked with his White House staff, and that Mueller is going to try and recreate all of these meetings and get a fuller picture of this, he has serious reason to be concerned. Now, look, you probably can't, and this is a bit of a legal dispute over this, you probably can't indict a sitting president. Some people think you can, some people think you can't. But this is if Mueller builds that case, we're going to be in a whole new world. He's going to have to decide what to do with that. Does he make a recommendation to Congress? Does Congress care? Do they do anything about it? So I feel like the political system has not actually caught up with how serious this investigation is, just because there's so much else going on in the country and in politics.
And President Trump keeping other things going on with his comments and more. But Carol, if it's obstruction of justice, I mean, the beginning of this was about collusion. Is obstruction of justice a weak fallback for Robert Mueller? What about the collusion investigation? Yes or no? Did it happen? People want to know that.
Good question.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They want to know that. And it's something we also want to know, as you're surely aware. However, I think it's wrong to describe it as a fallback. You know, many of the president's actions, starting with the way he handled Michael Flynn and the way he handled Jim Comey, lead a good prosecutor to that question.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the latest on Robert Mueller's investigation into Russia and the presidential campaign of Donald Trump. Carol Lenig is with us. She's been covering this for The Washington Post. Ryan Lizza from The New Yorker is here. And you can join us as well. What are your questions out of everything we've heard on where Mueller's looking, and who do you think told Russian trolls who to target on Facebook? Does it all sound kind of like a spy novelty? Russian billionaires and the FBI busting pre-dawn into Paul Manafort's house. What if they get the president's men but not the president? What then? And how do we settle this in a way that protects future elections? Some do not want to talk about this. This was Sean Spicer. Of course, he is out of there now, but was a press secretary for a long time at the White House, deflecting all questions with Paula Ferris on ABC last Thursday.
Has the Mueller team reached out to you at all?
I'm not going to discuss that issue at all.
Have you hired a lawyer?
I'm not going to discuss that issue at all.
So you haven't been subpoenaed?
I'm not going to discuss that issue at all.
Did you ever hear inside the White House that Mueller should be fired?
I'm not going to discuss that issue at all.
I guess he's not going to discuss this issue at all. Vice President Mike Pence did talk about it a little with CBS this morning. Last week, he said the White House is cooperating.
We're fully cooperating with the special counsel, and we'll continue to do that. Okay. I've made clear that during my time on the campaign, I was not aware of any contacts or any collusion with Russian officials, and I stand by that. And as I said, we'll provide any information the special counsel requires.
Not aware, not aware, not aware. Carol Lenig, can you take us back to July when we now have learned that law enforcement went into Paul Manafort's home, no knock, search warrant there, picked the lock and busted in pre-dawn. What exactly happened there, and what does it indicate?
Well, when we wrote about the actual search being executed back in July, I think actually we may have written it in the first week of August. Mm-hmm. When we wrote about this unusual activity, What we did know was that a lot of materials that Manafort had basically had prepared for him by his lawyer and that he was studying for his congressional testimony, all of these documents about what he was going to say, what he should say, were seized. And that was a contentious matter because they were essentially an attorney-client communication, and many people were wondering, why in the world would you take those?
That's what all that was about, busting in before dawn to get his notes?
Okay. I'm saying that's the first thing we knew about.
Okay.
The second thing we knew about was that a ton of bank records, personal bank records were seized, financial records. And remember, we did not know at the time that it was a no-knock warrant. We knew that they had executed a warrant. Later, the Times reported those great details. And that creates an extra burden on the prosecutors, the FBI agents, to establish to a judge that there is a concern not only about a crime, but a concern that documents may disappear, documents may be destroyed, that they're in danger of losing important evidence. That's a pretty high threshold. And the financial record, seems to me, became much more important in that search than anything else. We don't know the full reason that the prosecutor wants all this, but you can bet that they're looking at whether or not they have enough evidence to establish a crime about what Paul Manafort has disclosed about his own personal finances and whether or not he told the truth to his lawyers and to Congress about the extent of his interaction with Russian officials, Ukrainian officials, various bank accounts, how he was paid. It's all going to the question, did he lie? Did he conceal?
Ryan Lizard, there's also, we've learned, more here, a FISA warrant from the FBI that gave them permission last year, at a couple of points, to listen in on electronic communications of Paul Manafort. What does that indicate? That opens up another river of information. Mueller must have all that now.
Yeah, that's something that I believe CNN has reported and that CBS has followed up on. Although interestingly, I don't know if the Times and the Post have confirmed that. And these FISA warrants are, you know, secret, and their existence is really difficult for reporters to confirm and report on. So I think it's sort of surprising that it was a FISA warrant and not a traditional, criminal. Domestic criminal warrant. So if indeed that reporting is accurate and it is indeed a FISA warrant, that's a significant deal because think about the burden to go into the FISA court and get that.
You have to make a case to a judge that you have cause to go in for that level of surveillance of an American citizen.
Absolutely. And the political implications are pretty serious because he is someone associated with an active presidential campaign. So that's a big deal, and according to the CNN report, this is the second time that they actually had a FISA warrant on him. Previously, in 2014, CNN reported they also had one on him and then dropped it, and obviously no charges were ever brought. So Manafort is obviously being investigated in a very, very serious manner, and I think, you know, a couple of big questions about it do they have evidence of financial crimes from his time as a foreign lobbyist, and is that what this is all pointing towards, or are they using those potential crimes to sort of squeeze him and get more information about the Russia investigation and potential collusion, and get him to offer up information about the Trump campaign or Trump himself? But they're obviously looking at him in an incredibly intense manner.
You call this the tantalizing evidence of the white whale of Russian investigators, outright collusion. Scott in Nashua, New Hampshire. Scott, thank you for calling. You're on the air with Ryan Liz and Carolina.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, there hasn't been much discussion about money laundering investigations involving Trump, but it seems to me, for what it's worth, that direct collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia is going to be very difficult to prove. But money laundering, to me, seems the bigger issue. And having done recent coursework as part of my job in anti-money laundering, the red flags that are raised through Trump's real estate deals, say through Deutsche Bank, where he couldn't get a loan through American banks, and then Deutsche Bank being investigated for money laundering, just on and on, a number of red flags that go up.
On the money laundering front, Scott, let us pick that one up. And Carol, I mean, people look at the money laundering, and if that's where this should end up, is that success for Robert Mueller, or was he tasked to go out and find out about whether there was collusion, and he ends up, you know, bringing stuff out about Trump's business life? Okay, fair enough, but is that the heart of the issue here?
So the caller raises an excellent question about the potential financial shenanigans that may have happened in various loans and in investments in Trump properties. We don't know what happened, but it's a good question. It's a good area of inquiry. However, keep in mind that Bob Mueller's charge was to look into Russian, first and foremost, mm-hmm. Russian meddling in our election, mm-hmm. and the possibility of collusion with the Trump campaign, and then finally, any matters that directly arise out of that investigation. Now, I can already see that the special counsel's interpretation of directly arise is properly broad. If he sees a lie in the course of his work, he's digging deeper into whether or not he has evidence that that lie is related in some way to this case. And Ryan's absolutely right. A ton of people are being squeezed in this. It's sort of a coarse prosecutorial term, but Manafort's son-in-law has been approached and questioned to add heat to Paul Manafort. Michael Flynn's son has been now seeking legal counsel because he's also under investigation. That's a very painful place for any subject of an investigation to be, to have their son also under scrutiny. And I think every possible way in which any of these people have done something in the course of their campaign or transition work that is illegal, they will be asked about it six ways to Sunday to get to the answer of the central questions: was there collusion, and what did you know about the meddling of the Russian government? As for money laundering, we'll see what Bob Mueller does about that. So far, those questions have not been posed to the White House. That doesn't mean they haven't been posed to our U.S. government and to the Department of Treasury.
Julie in New Orleans. Thank you for calling, Julie. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Tom, I want to pose two questions to your guest in reference to responsibility. And what does that mean? Number one, it seems that the president is never responsible for whatever he does or whatever he says. It's always, somebody told me, I heard that, you know, what have you. It seems like the Russian investigation is circling around all that. I wonder, in the end, if you hire somebody to work for you, shouldn't you be responsible for the benefits that this person is bringing to you? That's number one. And number two, Facebook lie for months. Are they in a position where they need to be investigated and see where that money came from and whether there is somebody inside Facebook favoring the elected president?
On the ads that were bought there. Let's go to Facebook first. Ryan, what about, there's been developments there. Facebook is now cooperating, but they've also, they've been required to turn over documents.
Yeah, I was going to say that's probably the third area of the sort of major revelations in the last week. One is on Trump and investment mm-hmm. and obstruction of justice. One is on Manafort. And then the third is this area of did the Russians do more on Facebook than we initially knew. And this is an intense area of interest for congressional investigators who have been, and I think it's safe to say that Facebook has not dealt with the PR problem this has caused them very well in the last week. There's been a lot of pressure on them to offer more disclosure. And again, this would be a sort of serious development if somehow actors working, maybe cutouts working for the Russian government, somehow had sophisticated knowledge of how to target potential Trump voters using Facebook, and had a much broader and more expensive campaign during the election than we realized.
But is that the question here? Where would they get that sophisticated knowledge? Is that a potential collusion point? That, is that the idea?
If I were an investigator and as a journalist, that's what I would want to know: is if you're some guy sitting in a sitting in a room in Moscow buying Facebook ads, how do you know what precincts to target? How do you know where in Wisconsin or these other states? I mean, I think that one of the most frightening questions would be, did they have any inside knowledge of political targeting that made this more than just, you know, a bunch of kids throwing everything at the wall? And I think that's a major question for investigators.
Questions, not answers at this point, and that's important, but a lot of activity reported on in just the last week, and we're looking at it around Special Counsel Robert Mueller. Here was Facebook CEO on Facebook Live last Thursday trying to get out in front of this.
I care deeply about the democratic process and protecting its integrity. Facebook's mission is all about giving people a voice and bringing people closer together. Those are democratic values, and we're proud of them. I don't want anyone to use our tools to undermine democracy. That's not what we stand for.
Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg right there. Carol, you know, sometimes this can feel like a mounting pile of evidence, and other times it can feel like, gosh, there's just a lot of pieces here and there, and how does it come together? You heard our caller in New Orleans say, you know, when does it come right down to culpability, and who's responsible for what? Are we getting close to understanding Robert Mueller's view of that? Could that still be a year away? Are we 6 weeks away? Where are we in this?
My sense, only from covering cases like this enmeshing the White House and allegations of corruption and crime, is that this is going to be a long road. We are not going to hear Bob Mueller's answer, I would guess, until next year. Meanwhile, reporters are digging like crazy at a dizzying pace into lots of the ways in which they can see sort of the mirror or the shadows of Mueller's work and also their own independent reporting. And I think it's fascinating how these pieces are actually coming together. We don't know the final answer, but just a few months ago, nobody ever thought there would be a connection, and certainly the president insisted there was none, a connection between anybody on his campaign and Russian officials that had an ear of Putin. And indeed, now we know that many did. And the Post is written about a campaign official who was an advisor to on foreign official sort of contacts, and he was constantly trying to set up a meeting between candidate Trump and President Putin. So things are coming together. It's going to be a little while before everybody has their nice, tidy package of an answer, but I think it's coming.
You've got every intelligence agency in a position to know, Chris Eliza writes, has said that there is definitive proof Russia was seeking to meddle in the 2016 election with the purpose of helping Trump and hurting Clinton, the CIA, the FBI, the NSA. But there's a big spectrum still, Ryan, of potential outcomes here. Describe those for us.
Well, it could be everything from, yes, Russia had a pretty sophisticated campaign to meddle in the election, and yes, they did try and establish some more formal links with the Trump campaign, but nothing ever became of it. And, you know, Trump took advantage of the hacking and dumping campaign, but didn't cross any legal lines, and you know, the obstruction case kind of falls apart, and we all sort of move on. I think that's one end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum is the exact opposite, that the attempts to infiltrate the Trump campaign and establish more formal links actually did materialize, and there was a kind of collusion that crossed legal lines, and, you know, we're in a, and if you go back to what we're talking about with Facebook, in the worst case scenario for Trump, it involved, and this is just pure speculation. I'm just talking about the spectrum of options here. But, it, you know, this sort of outright communication and collusion between the Russian government and the Trump campaign. That's why this could be, you know, largely innocent or a very serious, not to be too dramatic, but national security and democratic crisis. What happens if we learn of deeper links? What does it say about Trump's legitimacy? Those are pretty big questions. And I just want to go back to the caller's frustration with all of the drips that come out and trying to understand all of this. And I think it is very difficult. It's difficult for people who cover this. I can't imagine what it's like for people who don't cover it and are just kind of scanning the news every day. And, you know, we're all putting a lot on Bob Mueller, and it's not really Bob Mueller's job to paint a comprehensive picture of what Russia did in the election, right? He's looking at discrete crimes. He's sort of the cop on the beat trying to find if anyone committed a crime. And, you know, it's Congress's job to do the bigger picture. And so far, I don't think Congress is doing a very good job of helping the public understand the larger tapestry here.
Carol, 10 seconds. Do you see the potential makings of an impeachment here or something that will float away like mist?
I'm definitely not going to render an opinion there.
We have to wait. We have to see. Robert Mueller doing his work. Signals coming out, and they are very interesting signals. I want to thank the two of you for bringing them to us. Carol Lenny with The Washington Post. Keep at it. Thanks for joining us, Carol.
Thank you, Tom.
And Ryan Liz, a Washington correspondent for The New Yorker. Thank you, Ryan.
Hey, thank you, Tom.
In a moment, we'll talk about President Trump pro football and a weekend of national anthem protests at NFL games. This is On Point. Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. In Alabama last week, President Trump went on a tirade against NFL players not standing for the national anthem. This weekend, plenty did not stand. Others linked arms in protest. The NFL is suddenly a battlefield. We're going to talk about it. Freedom of speech, respect for the flag, sports and politics. You can join us. We could dive in almost anywhere here, but let's start in Detroit. National anthem singer there, Rico Lavelle, supported NFL players in the Take a Knee demonstration by kneeling at the end of his performance of the national anthem before the Detroit Lions game. Lavelle, who is African-American, put his fist in the air and took a knee as he ended the anthem.
For the land of the free and the home of the brave.
On a knee. So were many pro players this weekend, others linking arms in protest, in observance of what was going on here. It all started last week in Huntsville, Alabama. Not entirely, but this is when the president really got into it. Went after NFL players who take a knee during the anthem. We don't normally air this kind of rough language, but here was the president of the United States using it straight out on Americans exercising their freedom of speech in a very public setting.
Wouldn't you love to see one of these NFL owners, when somebody disrespects our flag, to say, get that son of a bitch off the field right now. Out. He's fired. He's fired!
That's the president. From the sound of it, they ate it up in Alabama, but lots of people did not eat it up over the weekend. On Fox yesterday, NFL studio analyst, former Pittsburgh Steelers quarterback Terry Bradshaw blasted President Trump for his response to players kneeling during the national anthem.
Probably like a lot of you, I was somewhat surprised that the president of the United States, came out attacking NFL players for them exercising the freedom of speech. While I don't condone the protest during our national anthem, this is America. If our country stands for anything, folks, what? It's freedom. People died for that freedom. And I'm not sure if our president understands those rights, that every American has the right to speak out and also to protest.
Former NFL quarterback Terry Bradshaw going after the president. But in the stands, were people responding to the president's perspective on this? Certainly, here's sound from the New England Patriots fans. This was yesterday, booing players who knelt during the national anthem. Well, read that as you will. Joining me now from Laurel, Maryland, is David Steele, senior writer for Sporting News, covers the NFL. David Steele, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
Great to have you here. Also with us from Washington is Christine Brennan, national sports columnist for USA Today, commentator for ABC News, CNN, PBS. Christine Brennan, welcome to On Point.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
I'm good. David Steele, what do you make of this? I guess we've never seen anything like it in total. You had Colin Kaepernick alone on a knee in protest, and now, over this weekend, all over the place you got protests. Some teams didn't even come out of the locker room, didn't want to be out there when the national anthem was played. Others linked arms, and others knelt. Others just took a knee. What's happening here, David?
We've come a long way since in the past year.
seeing where Colin Kaepernick was, where he really was by himself for a large part of his time in the league when he was protesting. A few scattered players around the league joining him and facing the same sort of condemnation. A lot of the same people, when you played that Terry Bradshaw clip, a lot of the broadcasters, a lot of the people who were very adamant about Kaepernick not being within his rights to do that, really kind of they switched sides. They sort of flipped on what they had said a year ago, and what they even said during this past offseason when Colin Kaepernick was out of work. The president kind of brought a lot of people who were not on common ground onto common ground, and that includes fans, includes other players, broadcasters, people in and around the league, and probably more shockingly than Andy, the owners, who stood up against a man who they supported financially and politically in a lot of ways, in saying, hey, he's now threatening everybody's freedom of speech, not just this one player who we've been more or less vilifying over the past year.
Christine, you had Robert Kraft, owner of the New England Patriots, very close by both accounts to President Trump, coming out and saying deeply disappointed in the president on this front. And suddenly, this is all over the place. What's the president's, is game the right word here? I don't know. In your view, Christine, why is he working this so hard?
Well, Tom, I think David, you and I can agree that we have no idea what's going on in Donald Trump's brain. So we'll agree on that. And you know, to stick to sports journalism, where
it's hard to, because he brought it up at a campaign rally, a political rally.
Oh, exactly. But no, but I mean, I'm happy to be in this world where sports and culture intersect. As you know, that's what I love to do more than anything else, and I haven't stopped talking about it all weekend. I don't know if Trump, you know, if he trying to just gin up his base. I have no idea. That's again an area for someone else to try to figure out what he's doing. Speculation probably doesn't help us in most of this stuff, but reality, the truth, what we do know is fact, is that he got this going. David's point is a great one. You know, Kaepernick was doing what he was doing, and things had calmed down. And of course, keep in mind, Kaepernick, this was a very calm, mild protest. One man, then joined by others over the last year, occasionally, also putting his money where his mouth was with $1 million donation over with many different charities. He's now reached close to $1 million in his own personal donations, Kaepernick has. So if you despise Colin Kaepernick, just stop and think about that for a moment, $1 million he is giving to charity. But that was what this was. And it was kind of Charlottesville, Trump's dreadful response to Charlottesville, horrid response, brought some of it back to light a little bit. But mostly it was dying down and just on the back burner. And then boom. And he did it. So if you want to point fingers, I guess we're in the pointing fingers phase of our culture. And he did it, no, she did it, back and forth kind of nonsense of childish stuff that we thought we left behind. And now it's in the White House. Okay, then let's do it. I'll do it. Trump started it. Trump led us to this point. He is the sole reason we are having this conversation, and he is the sole reason why over, 200 players protested and three teams didn't even come out for the national anthem. It is all on Donald Trump, and let's use words Donald Trump would know, you know, winning and losing. Well, guess who lost the weekend? Donald Trump. It was a disaster for him. And now he's trying to say in one tweet of many something about, well, even if they're linking arms, it's okay. You know, that's okay. Well, now,
but taking a knee is not, was the president's point in a tweet.
And he's moving the goalposts, though, to use another sports term, because he's now changing the rules. Because, of course, we all know that linking arms is a protest against Donald Trump, and now he's trying to, I guess, confuse people and say, oh, that's good. So he's lost. It was a disastrous turn of events for him. And he has seen, I think, the true nature, the good nature of this country.
You know, the Chicago Tribune, people responding from all over the place. Big editorial in the Chicago Tribune, Trump's fumbling grasp of democracy, they headlined it. They talked about Charlottesville. They said, to recap the scoring, Trump gives whites at a neo-Nazi rally more respect than he gives to black football players. They said players who take the knee aren't disrespecting the flag. They're living out the freedom it represents. about Donald Trump. They said, this is the Chicago Tribune, a conservative paper. He can't speak from the heart on the subject without sounding like an apologist for hate mongers. And this, going forward, Chicago Tribune, how about he leaves discussions of free speech, race relations, and religious protection to leaders who still have credibility? But here was the president getting ready to get on Air Force One and head back to Washington from New Jersey yesterday, said his criticism of the NFL is not about race.
No, this has nothing to do with race. I've never said anything about race. This has nothing to do with race or anything else. This has to do with respect for our country and respect for our flag.
David Steele, you're African-American. Does this have anything to do with race?
Yeah, he knows better than to say that and think that people are going to believe him. I mean, I think he has a track record, he has history, and so many of the players who did stand up, and this, we're talking black and white,
yep,
players who spoke up, you know, they pointed directly at that, at the contradiction of the one that that everyone's been talking about for weeks now. His response to Charlottesville, to neo-Nazis and white supremacists, where he said, you know, there's blame on many sides and there's many fine people on both sides, to now where he condemned the entire sport, which is the majority African-American, and specifically an African-American player who jump-started the protests a year ago in the first place, and who he's picked at from time to time. And we also have to remember that also linked in with this, that it was just barely a week ago that, you know, he went after the ESPN commentator, Jemele Hill,
yes,
for what she said about him, labeling, you know, calling him outright a white supremacist.
Yep.
And again, the response was, she should be fired. I mean, he is denying a fundamental right to an entire class of people, and that is what his mode of operation has been, and it all just sort of came together this weekend when he consciously took a shot at that player, the entire league, and he galvanized him in ways that just had not happened already. I mean, it gave visibility to a protest and to an issue that a lot of people had sort of tuned out for a long, long time. And now the focus is back on it. Focus is on his reluctance to it. The focus is back on the people who have been resistant to it. And it's opened a lot of eyes that I think people were either willfully shutting or they were just sort of ignoring, and now everybody's eyes are wide open about it.
We're looking at the uproar in the NFL over the take a knee and the president's harsh criticism of it, rough language. Corey in Atlanta, Georgia. Corey, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I just wanted to make a couple points that really were outstanding to me this weekend. First of all, Sundays are pretty sacred to me and a lot of other people in this country. It's your time to unplug from politics, and I kind of don't.
Sacred for church or sacred for football, Corey?
Sacred for both, really. Some people have their Sunday sacred for the church, and it's like a ritual. You know, football Sundays after mass,
okay. Yep.
Family meal.
Yep.
Those things kind of go together, and I've been doing that all my life. I played sports all my life. But then again, yeah, Sunday is that time to unplug. You know, I don't want to deal with politics on Sunday. I don't want to deal with politics on Sunday. College football Sunday. I got 17 weeks to enjoy the NFL.
So what do you think about the president then here? What do you think?
Okay, that's the second part. And I don't think he understands the history of athletes when it comes to being outspoken. If you go back to Muhammad Ali, incarcerated for not wanting to fight in the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't heard anybody mention that. Jim Brown also. We've had scores of athletes from the Olympics with the black fist in the air. There was a white man on that stage that gave those two guys his black gloves to wear. He was an Australian runner, and he was a great man. But these are things that have been going on for a long time.
Right or wrong for NFL players to take a knee during the anthem? To you, Corey.
It's not my choice, but I applaud them for standing and using their rights. And mainly, I applaud NFL owners for standing with their guys. These are guys that they handpick to come to these teams that these kids have played since Pee Wee League, high school ball, college ball. They get to the point where they get to the pros. They have earned that right. These NFL owners know that they had elite people on their teams. These guys have dedicated their life to perfection of their craft.
Yeah, Corey, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. Christine Brennan, do the owners stick with the players here? Donald Trump is going after their ratings, failing. and encouraging people not to go if they see more of this. Can the owners stand up to that?
No, absolutely. They have. You know, Donald Trump has really picked on the one group of people who can meet him in terms of power, in terms of decibel level, whatever you might say, reach on Twitter and social media. All these players have Twitter accounts. They have followings, not just, Tom, in blue states, but in red states.
And LeBron James from the NBA world coming out and saying, you know, calling the president a bum, saying back off, the talking about their, you know, Stephen Curry's disinvitation by the president. LeBron James saying, look, the Oval Office was respected before you got there, Mr. President. That's
absolutely
a big voice.
And so, again, it, you know, I think over the we've watched in aghast horror, whatever, over the last 8, 9 months, 10 months, as this man has done what he has done from the Oval Office, and a lot of people couldn't respond. Well, he's picked on the wrong guys. You know, the schoolyard bully learned early on that you're not supposed to pick on the big guys, the football players. And from Roger Goodell to D. Smith, the union chief, all of them just so critical of Trump. And this notion that Trump has that, well, it's always about crowd size, I guess, right, with him. Well, in this case, the TV ratings, I'm sure, are better today. Everyone tuned in to watch what was going on. The national anthems were shown. People were interested. I didn't see many empty seats when I saw these games, and it looked like people showed up. They spend so much money on tickets. It's just counterintuitive. As a businessman, Donald Trump, you would think, would know this. If you're spending that kind of money, you want to go and partake and enjoy the experience in the game.
Well,
and most Americans clearly are not bothered by it to the point that Donald Trump is suggesting. So he's wrong. He's all wrong. He's got it all wrong, and he's and shown over the last 72 hours. He's absolutely, completely opposite in terms of what the facts are and what the mood of the country seems to be.
David, what do you think of the president using this very rough language? Sons of bitches. I mean, son, you know, any son of a bitch who doesn't... That's from a president, I've never heard it in public like that on a stage and aimed at a particular group of people.
Yeah, he made it personal. And I think that's a lot of what drove the reaction, the immediate reaction by not just the players, but again, the owners, players from other sports, as you mentioned, LeBron James and Steph Curry. He made it very personal and made it very insulting, and they took it personally, and that is what motivated them to say, you will not speak to me as an American citizen, as somebody who is engaged in this country and the issues that is involved. You're bringing our families into it. I mean, that insult itself, you know, it points at Colin Kaepernick's mother and the mothers of the players who, for the most part, were the guiding forces to bring these guys onto the platform that they're able to use now. And that's something that everybody can relate to. And the president just so completely misread that and gauged that so poorly. You know, how he did and why he did, that's for better people than me to try to figure out, try to, as Christine said, try to get inside his head. I'm not the one, but he clearly did not understand his audience. I think he thought his audience was going to be exactly like the one in Alabama he was speaking to,
yep,
that he had that on his side, and he was proven wrong in a very loud way.
David, we're out of time right there. David Steele with Sporting News. Thanks for being with us. And Christine Brennan at USA Today. Our thanks to you both. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.